From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. This week, we see increased interest from politicians of all parties in the idea of FAFSA simplification, and we see a renewed debate over the mission and purpose of public higher education set off by recent actions by Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin. I'm Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed, and I'm filling in this week for Casey Green as moderator on This Week. In our first segment, we'll be talking FAFSA simplification. FAFSA is the 108-question free application for federal student aid. The FAFSA is important not only for federal aid. Many states and individual colleges use FAFSA as the basis or part of the basis for their own aid programs. Everyone these days seems to agree in theory that FAFSA simplification makes sense, but some would go further than others. Joining us today are Justin Drager, president of the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, Kristen Conklin of HCM Strategists, and Kim Cook, Executive Director of the National College Access Network. Kim, I'd like to start with you. Why is FAFSA simplification important?
As we think about college attainment in this country and how to move the needle, obviously affordability is an important part of that conversation. Of the students who didn't file a FAFSA last year, 1.3 million would have had a full federal Pell Grant. So when we look at the numbers, when we look at numbers like that, we know that we have an opportunity to make some changes that will really impact attainment.
Kristen, this seems to be bipartisan political support for this idea. Why do you think everyone's gotten behind this?
I think it's an issue that has ripened over time. We've really been focused on experimenting on improving the FAFSA for over a decade. We have research that's been conducted by Harvard, by Columbia, by H&R Block. We have experimentation with the Department of Education and Treasury. We're at a point now where we can be really confident that there are many fewer questions that will give us approximately the same results and make it much easier for those 1.3 million students to access the financial aid they need.
Justin, your members, of course, deal with the results of whatever happens to FAFSA. And I know that there are some concerns about maybe going too far. As you watch this debate, what do you see that you like? What do you see that maybe concerns you or your members?
I don't think anybody's arguing with simplification. Clearly, there's a lot of data showing that even the perception of this being too complicated can keep students out of applying for financial aid. What I like, and I think what our members like, is the progress that we've made so far has relied heavily on technology. And we would like to see less of a debate about simplification in terms of numbers of questions asked, and more a conversation about simplification and how we leverage technology so that we can balance simplifying this process for our neediest students, but still having enough questions that maintain the integrity of the program so that we can differentiate between truly needy versus those who just appear needy.
So Justin, when you talk about technology, can you explain what you're talking about there?
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Education took a big step forward several years ago when they implemented the IRS data retrieval tool. This is a good example of us utilizing technology to allow students and parents to simply import tax information directly into their application. It also eases burden on students and parents because we don't have to then re-verify that information. It's verified because it's coming directly from the IRS. Then ED has done other things like implement skip logic. So based on how a student answers some questions, they might be able to skip a whole host of other questions. This is the dynamic way that we want to go about simplifying this process. So again, those really needy students can zip right through the process.
Now, Kim, some advocates are saying that it would be good to go to like a postcard or a two-question FAFSA. When you think about FAFSA simplification, how simple or minimal do you think it could be or should be?
There are certainly studies that say we could come very close to current estimates using far less data points. We would like to start building from the ground up. We would like to use those two, and if there are other questions that are necessary for the federal piece, fill that in. As Justin pointed out, we've made tremendous strides, particularly in our use of technology with the data retrieval tool and the skip logic for FAFSA on the web that allows a student to skip over questions that are not relevant to them as determined by previous answers. What I think is important here is this next frontier of simplification, not only talking about the number of questions, but talking about the data that we use to fill that in and the great promise we have in using previous one-year earlier data, as we call it prior year data, to allow students more time to complete that form and digest the answers, and more time for institutions to package and award students.
Kristen, do you think a two-question FAFSA is something that could work?
I think what can work is the consensus that exists between advocates and stakeholders like Justin, Kim, and myself. We all agree that there are data elements currently provided in a more reliable and easy-to-retrieve fashion for the IRS, and we want to focus on the fewest of those IRS-based variables that can be shared for purposes of determining eligibility for aid.
Justin, one of the issues that I've heard some concern about is that there are individuals who may be income poor but actually have means. Do you worry that if we go too far on simplification, that some wealthy individuals will be able to appear needy?
Yeah, that's the exact concern. Let me give you one statistic. This is just looking at one school. So a Big Ten school who looked at the total number of Pell eligible students that they have, and then figuring out the school uses a separate application to dig into these families' finances even further, and found that on any given year in the last couple of years, 10 to 15% of their Pell students don't qualify for institutional need-based aid once they dig in even deeper. That's not an insignificant number. Now, some schools are always going to use a separate application because they have significant institutional financial aid that they're giving out. What we want to do is not reach a tipping point where we've simplified the federal form so much that you have tons of schools now going in with separate applications. That's like taking a step forward and two step back for students. So we just want to reach this sort of balance between making sure we have enough information that's easy on the student to import, like using IRS data retrieval and prior year, but not so little that now we've just introduced an entirely separate application at the institutional level.
So, Justin, I want to stick with you here for a minute and go to this issue you raised of the individual institutions' applications and also their state aid applications. How different are institutional priorities from one another or states from one another? Some people just sort of imagine that, well, it's financial aid. Why would they not ask the same questions?
Yeah, I think we have one of the strengths of the higher education system here in the United States is a variety of institutions. They bring a variety of strengths, and they have a variety of different financial aid packages that they offer focused on whatever their strength is or their goals. And particularly when it comes to need-based aid, some schools have a very limited pool of funds. And what they're trying to do is give those funds to students based on their relative need, because they don't have enough maybe to award everybody who has need. But they can't really get a true, the simpler you go on the application and the methodology, everybody starts to look the same. So for some schools, they're always going to be interested in digging a little bit deeper than we will at the federal level, where we're really talking about offering Pell Grants and maybe some other forms of subsidies. So we have different policy priorities based on the type of institution compared to where the federal government is, and then add in the complexity of the state. There's a way to balance this. We just think it's not two questions, but it is trying to find the simplest way, leveraging technology and time, to make it really easy on students and parents.
Kim, you mentioned earlier briefly the prior year issue. Could you elaborate a little bit on why that's important?
The current time frame has students completing their FAFSAs in January, as early as January 1st. However, many states and institutions have priority deadlines that could be as early as late February and typically mid-March. For a family that's just completing their taxes or getting the materials they need to complete their taxes only in the first week of February, this doesn't really give the students a lot of time to complete that application. As a result, many students complete the FAFSA using estimates because they want to be timely and meet the deadlines. On the back end, that comes back to the students in the form of verification. So they have to basically go back and get their tax transcripts to say that their estimates were on or close as reported.
For students who are aid eligible, do you usually see a lot of income gain year to year, or are they basically in the same place?
NCAN members work with primarily low-income students, and sadly in this country, there is not much movement in their family income over the years.
Kristen, I'm curious, again, on the political perspective, this is an issue where President Obama is talking about it, and, you know, Lamar Alexander is talking about it. Do you think that there is enough interest, even if they're not at identical plans, that they could actually do something?
Absolutely. I think that there's a feeling in the community that the time is now, that the window has opened, and that we have a real chance to fix this critical on-ramp to college affordability. College affordability is one of the most important concerns facing Americans today, and this is a practical solution that is within hand, and I'm very optimistic that something will happen. And I think that what will happen will be more than just changes to a financial aid process, form, if you will, but also to what we communicate to students and when we communicate to them. Right now, we give them something called an ESC. What is that for us from a student's perspective? What it technically is, and this is what I've heard both Democrat and Republican Congress people ask about, it's the amount of aid you do not get. It's time to stop being cute and take advantage of this opportunity to give students clear information on how much federal aid they are going to get.
And so would you just totally reverse that? Because isn't the advantage of the EFC that it would be something you could compare institution to institution?
No, the EFC is incredibly useful to institutions, and that wouldn't go away in terms of what we communicate. But to the students, we want to communicate early to them, this is the amount of federal aid that you're going to get, and then you can shop institutions knowing how much aid is likely to come your way, and before you even apply. Right now, you don't even know how much you're getting until after you've been admitted. If you think about it, we're having a conversation nationally. What would it take to make community college tuition free? Well, if you are a low-income student in this country and you've applied for a federal financial aid, you can learn early that in 48 states, community college is effectively free with your maximum Pell Grant. But right now, people don't get that information, and they don't get it before they apply.
It's interesting. As Kristen was just explaining that issue, it reminded me of some of the discussion of the net price calculator, or at least what people imagined it would do. Justin, as you look at what you hear from your members, did the net price calculator have a big impact on actually letting students and families know what they would get?
Probably not as wide as policymakers had hoped up front. For some schools who are using the net price calculator tailored to their institution, it's an incredibly useful tool in giving them an idea of how much it's going to cost to go there. For other schools who are using perhaps the federal template, which this is a good example of balancing the tension between accuracy and simplicity, the less input that a school requires on its net price calculator, the less precise output that student is going to get about the cost. The federal template, which is the minimal standard, is balanced on the simple side. So this is a good example, actually, of trying to figure out this tension between simplicity and accuracy. But like the other panelists, I'm very optimistic that we have a window here where we can make some forward progress, even more than we've made in the last couple of years, to get this right for students.
Well, I have to say, I had the opportunity last year to watch a focus group of parents of a range of economic backgrounds talk about the process of getting their kids into college and applying to college, and the frustration and confusion about FAFSA was very real, and I could certainly see firsthand how it would discourage people. It's been a real pleasure to talk today, because so many discussions we have about policy end with everyone saying, well, they won't be able to work it out. Today we were able to hear about something where there is optimism of a solution. So Justin, Kristen, Kim, thank you so much for sharing your expertise today. In our second segment today, we look at the implications of a controversy involving the University of Wisconsin and Governor Scott Walker, a Republican who may have presidential ambitions. This year, he proposed a $300 million budget cut for the University of Wisconsin system, and also turning the system into a somewhat independent agency, although details remain to be seen. And in his budget plan, he appeared to rewrite the Wisconsin idea, a prized tradition in the state, and it also looked like he was trying to remove the search for truth as a university mission in its official definition in state law. Governor Walker has blamed drafting mistakes for the brouhaha, but there's plenty of evidence that the governor's office had repeated meetings about these ideas, and they've caused quite a bit of discussion in Wisconsin and nationally. We have here to discuss that issue Alan Knox, a longtime professor of educational leadership at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and John Thielen, a professor at the University of Kentucky, who is one of the leading historians of American higher education. John, I'd like to start with you and ask a general question not unique to Wisconsin, which is, how much does it matter and how much has it mattered historically for a college or a state university system to define its mission, to say, we're about X? Since that's what they're debating here in Wisconsin, does that matter?
Yes, I think that at very least, mission statements are inspiring. They are a public expression. I think probably the worst danger in recent years is that sometimes they can be made generic and saccharine. But they also, I think, often have a legal standing, and they're not trifles. And should not be altered, easily or capriciously.
Alan, when word got out that the concept of the Wisconsin idea was being tinkered with or maybe even eliminated, there was an intense reaction. Why do people in Wisconsin care so much about the Wisconsin idea? And I'm wondering if you could explain to our listeners what it means.
The reaction that was so quick and so strong reflects the fact that the idea of the Wisconsin idea became well embedded in the institution. And it did so for two decades, in a sense, before people began using the term the Wisconsin idea soon after President Van Hise began as President of the University of Wisconsin. So it's been so much a fabric of the institution that it was an assault on something that many people were taking for granted. There have been efforts several years ago with a previous chancellor to negotiate something similar to what Governor Walker was suggesting right now, and there was a major resistance to that, and that chancellor is no longer here.
And Alan, for non-Wisconsin listeners, just could you explain, what does it mean, the Wisconsin idea?
It is an example of a slogan, basically, rather than a formal mission statement, that evolved because there were some actions taken at the state and at the national level in terms of legislation. And the Smith-Lever legislation that followed up on the land grant Morrill Act in 1862. And so those two decades beforehand, there were many people who were doing the Wisconsin idea, in a sense, before the slogan became popular. And so the meaning of it was the engagement of faculty members from the University of Wisconsin both in relation to state government in various ways, in the early years particularly, and with the people of the state and many organizations throughout the state. And so its very success has been a reflection of that heavy involvement between people on the one hand and university resources on the other in a mutually beneficial way.
John, as you look at the history of American higher education and state systems of higher education, how do you view the Wisconsin idea in terms of setting out the mission of public higher education? Is there something special about Wisconsin that goes beyond just the land-grant mission that you would see of a university in every state?
First, a disclaimer. I wasn't there when the expression was first used, but I have done some checking in national magazines and periodicals over the past century, and on numerous occasions I see such famous authors and journalists as Lincoln Steffens writing articles with titles like Sending a State to College, and it focuses specifically on the University of Wisconsin. They refer to the Wisconsin idea, and it's truly broadcast to a nationwide audience as a model. And allow me a contemporary sequel to that. A few years back at the University of Kentucky, our Board of Trustees took the trouble to seek out models for what we would like to be and how we would like to improve. And a contingent of our trustees actually spent a week visiting the University of Wisconsin. And in their discussions, when they would come back and talk to faculty and other groups, they would refer explicitly to the Wisconsin idea. And they said, this is what our aspiration is. So it does have, I think, a significant impact, not only within Wisconsin, but nationwide.
So while Governor Walker has backed away from the so-called drafting errors of the budget bill, he hasn't backed away from his budget cuts. And Alan, I was wondering, as you look at the scene there, how damaging would the $300 million in cuts be to the university system?
Two answers to that. One is that if that cut does persist, and it hasn't been negotiated to a lower level, the damage would be great indeed. Not necessarily to the Wisconsin idea, but to many programs that would have to sustain cuts of that proportion. The other answer to that is that in the past, when proposals were made to reduce university spending for various reasons and so on, part of the dynamic that helped to reduce that reduction of budget has been the many people from around the state who have been benefiting from the Wisconsin idea types of partnerships with the university, who have put pressure on their local legislators to do something to reduce those cuts in some fashion. And that hasn't always been as successful as people helped. But instead of having faculty administrators be the only people who complained about the results of those cuts, people who have directly benefited, not just by having their children in school here, but have directly benefited from them, who provided a local influence on legislation.
John, there's obviously a lot of attention to these cuts, both because of their magnitude, because of the University of Wisconsin, and because Scott Walker may be running for president. How do you view the Wisconsin battle fitting into sort of national debates about the mission of public higher education?
Alan has far more close-hand knowledge about the direct impact, as he's discussed. I think also the symbolic spin-off from it is substantial, and I think the symbolic impact may be greater outside of Wisconsin. And what I see is yet another example of where, let's say, an ambitious governor who seeks higher office uses the flagship state university as a convenient ploy or target that you know it generates more heat than light, but also catapults into the spotlight. Although it seems to me in this case that spotlight and publicity may have had a very different effect than the aspiring governor thought it would.
But John, if I could stick with you for a minute, let's look at sort of the people who might run for the Republican nomination. Rick Perry spent quite a bit of time fighting with his flagship, and now we have Scott Walker doing the same. Obviously, there are Republicans who are very engaged in higher education policy in ways that are exciting to many academics. The free community college tuition comes from a Republican governor. But does it concern you that two potentially major candidates for the Republican nomination seem to view fighting with flagship universities as a good political thing?
Well, I'll tell you, tomorrow morning after Jeb Bush has his $100,000 a plate fundraising dinner on Wall Street, because he too is a Republican and a governor and knowledgeable about higher education. And I think in the case, for example, of Governor Perry in Texas, that a lot of his analyses of Texas A&M and the University of Texas, they actually ended up endorsing and supporting that the faculty at the state universities were indeed making a strong contribution and were not wasteful. And that if there were waste in the state universities, you would look elsewhere than the educational program and the faculty.
Alan, as somebody who is close to faculty there in Wisconsin, I wonder if you could talk about the reaction to the governor's statement that people concerned about budget cuts should just teach an extra course each semester.
This would not be an attractive course of action from their standpoint, and part of the symbolism of the of Governor Walker's positions has been the notion that the university should be mainly concerned with teaching, all of the business about research and publication and outreach and so on is something that the taxpayers shouldn't have to pay for. And so budget reductions are related to reduction of taxes reflected in the state budget. And so I think it's an appeal from the governor's standpoint to people who are interested in reducing taxes at various levels, local, state, and national level. And so it's an easy target to use in that regard.
John, what do you think, looking not just at Wisconsin, but nationally, about this argument that, oh, well, if the faculty would just teach more, we wouldn't have a problem?
I think that's going to always be a convenient and recurrent theme. It's, I think, a misplaced populism and an envy of being a professor, which is indeed one of the great professions and jobs of all times. But I think usually there's a sequel where more thoughtful analysis, such as happened in the case in Texas, that usually I think voters and most legislators come around and realize that they're fortunate to have a great multi-purpose research flagship state university. I certainly actually, if Wisconsin doesn't want the University of Wisconsin, I know of several governors who would like to have it.
Well, that's a very generous offer, and we'll see if any of them respond. Alan, John, thank you so much for sharing your expertise today. I'd also like to thank our first panel for discussing changes in FAFSA, and to remind our listeners that we welcome their comments on the This Week page on the Inside Higher Ed website. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.